There's been many times where I've been on my turntables, or I've been on my congas, or I've been on whatever I'm playing,
right.
And I'm just playing, and then I don't record. And I've had somebody with me like, oh my God, did you record that? I'm like, no, I didn't. Right. What? Why not? I'm like, because that wasn't the important part.
Right.
Me getting it out was important.
Yes.
And I think that's missing now, because when people sit down to create, they're not really creating, they're manufacturing. It's kind of like making dog food. I got to make dog food for large canines that actually taste good for them. So no one ever says they create dog food. They say they manufacture it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do that with your music, it's more of a manufacturing process. Mm. Because you're so busy guiding it somewhere. Where's the expression part? Right? So what I do is I express, and then later I find out where that can fit.
You're listening to The Rhythm of Rebellion with Taina Asili. Welcome to another episode of The Rhythm of Rebellion. I'm your host, Taina Asili, and today we delve into the world of a true musical legend. DJ Johnny Juice is an award-winning composer, producer, turntablist, engineer, musician, b-boy, graffiti writer, MC, educator, lecturer, percussionist, and mentor. His journey through hip-hop's evolution has not only witnessed its birth, but left an indelible mark on this vibrant culture. Raised in the Bronx, he was on the front lines when hip-hop emerged right on his doorstep. His work, especially with Public Enemy, is woven into the very fabric of hip-hop history. With over 29 years in the industry, DJ Johnny Juice's production and scratching skills have graced projects by legendary artists like the Beastie Boys, Slick Rick, Leaders of the New School, and DMC. In 2008, he was inducted into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame as a member of Public Enemy, and he took the stage with them in 2013 as they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Johnny and I are not just connected through the Rhythm of Rebellion, but also through the beat of collaboration. He joined me as a percussionist in my group for some unforgettable performances. Furthermore, Johnny remixed one of my well-loved songs, Sofrito, which became a part of the benefit compilation album, Viva Puerto Rico, a project I produced to support those in need after Hurricane Maria. As we celebrate hip-hop's 50th anniversary, it's a perfect time to reflect on Johnny's enduring impact on this genre that has transformed our world. Hey, Johnny, welcome to the Rhythm of Rebellion. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good. I am very excited to have you on the show today. I've been thinking about when was going to be the right time to bring you on and share the bounty of wisdom and experience that you have in your art forms, the many art forms that you do. I think that there is no better time than now to make it happen. So thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
At the top of the show, I shared with the listeners, again, all of this incredible work that you have done. And of course, that's just like the tip of the iceberg of all the beautiful things you've done. You know, your journey through the world of hip hop has been quite a remarkable one. And I wanted to see if you could share some of your insights into how you witnessed the birth of hip hop and how those early experiences contributed to your life, as well as the culture of music and social change in your community.
Well, I was fortunate to have been raised in the Bronx in the 70s, right as the Fania Salsa movement started catching strength and speed. And coincidentally, hip hop was kind of almost formed in a parallel path. It's no coincidence that both of them occurred in New York City, specifically the Bronx area. Primarily because of New York being such a melting pot. I mean, there's a lot of issues right now with being that it's supposedly the 50th anniversary of hip hop. Who contributed, who created? There's a movement by the ADOS and FBA stating that only black people created it and Puerto Ricans came later. But, you know, putting that aside, you know, I watched a whole bunch of artistic expression congeal and form the basis and the foundation of what would be hip hop. I saw the Boogaloo movement, where there was Latin music but with English lyrics, which kind of mixed a doo-wop and salsa type thing happening. I experienced the James Brown phenomenon with the breaks. Not surprisingly, a lot of those breaks, like Give It Up, Turn It Loose, the break was essentially James Brown freestyling over a conga bed. So if you're saying, well, there's no Latino influence, I'm like, well, then why is it clap your hands? I would say that, right? So that rhythm was essential, and that's what made the breakers want to get down. The rockers at the time, I started out as a b-boy, but my mother was a hustle dancer. She was a salsera. She still is. She taught other people. I watched people in my family, my uncles, my aunts, they all danced, and they all did what later would be referred to as the rock dance, which became the basis for what we now look at the top rock. Before the breakers go to the floor, they would do this rock dance. Okay. And initially, according to some of the first generation cats, that started out a certain way and it came from a certain area, but the Latinos infused it with some of the salsa style and the things that you would see that definitely came from us. So I saw that, and I saw the integration happening right before my eyes, and I just did. There wasn't any, what is that you're doing? What do we call this? What, you know, you don't really start documenting in that way until after the fact. And I got to see this firsthand and right in front of my face. And so I didn't know anything else but that. So I had no choice but to either follow along or just be like super like left field and not even, you know, join the movement. But there was nothing to join. It was kind of a wave, and I was a part of that wave.
Mm-hmm. How would you say those early experiences influenced social change in your community?
Well, I mean, a lot of people aren't aware of this. The hip hop movement that came out of the Bronx was a direct result of benign neglect, which was a social political experiment that was actually sanctioned by the US president at the time, basically denying social and necessary services to the citizens of New York City, especially the Bronx. So police, fire, garbage disposal, all of that. Garbage was piling up ridiculously in the Bronx back in the 70s. I remember that. There was garbage everywhere. We had these poles in New York where you could press a red one for fire and a blue one for the police. And they answer it. It's kind of like, you know, their central station where they, you know, I fall and I can't get up. And they wouldn't answer those. And there was a lot of tenement owners that were burning down their buildings for insurance money. It's basically, there was a movement to get us all out of the Bronx. So hip hop was literally a response to that. You hear that? That's police. They're here now.
So, right on time.
So right on time, right? But they weren't around then. And there was a couple of events that actually gave that movement some kind of traction nationwide. One was the blackout of 1977. When that happened, people started looting. There was a lot of news coverage, obviously. Also, the Yankees went to the World Series in 77 and 78. And when the blimp, you know, they had this, the Goodyear blimp flying around. The Goodyear blimp would fly around, and this is televised nationwide. And you can see fires all around the Bronx. It's like, what is going on in the Bronx right now? You know, we have the, you know, one of the number one teams, the number one team of all time, the New York Yankees. They're playing in the World Series, and they are surrounded by fires. It looked like, you know, it looks surreal if you saw that. And I'm sure a lot of people were like, hey, you know, what's going on over there?
Right.
So these things, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum, as they say.
So your work with Public Enemy has become, you know, iconic in the world of hip hop. Can you take us behind the scenes and share some moments where you really saw the impact that music had as a vehicle for change?
Well, I started life as a youth playing on my grandfather's bongos and his congas. That's how I started. Everybody starts that way in my family. He brings out all his instruments and everybody picks an instrument and then you play it. And most of the kids just play whatever until they get tired of it. I was the one that didn't get tired of it. So in 1986, my grandfather passed away, and on his deathbed, he gave me his bongos, which I thought were going to go to my uncle, who was his oldest son, who also is a phenomenal player. But he didn't get them. I got them. And coincidentally, that year, I ended up making my first record, so which I couldn't have told you that was going to happen. But musically, my family, my grandfather's family is from Guyana. That's one of those brujos, right? So there's a very strong connection to Yoruba and what they call Santeria, which most people just assume is some kind of witchcraft, anything, but it's not. It's a it's just an indigenous religious thing. But the drummer in that religion or whatever you want to call it is a sacred person. Not everyone's allowed to tell the story via the drum. Mm. So I was taught that at a young age, that this is something you don't just take this lightly.
Right.
You're not just playing a rhythm. You're sending a message to everyone. Right. And you have a responsibility that way. When I transitioned to being a DJ, I started scratching like I was playing my congas or my bongos.
Mm.
So instead of the jiggy jiggy jiggy, I would put the tacket the packet the packet the tacket the packet the book the tacket the packet the papa the tap the book. So my scratches were basically an emulation of my percussive style.
Wow.
And when I met Public Enemy, I moved to Long Island eventually. You know, we got a little money. You know how that goes. You moved out of the Bronx, moved to Long Island. I hooked up with some locals, you know, doing some little rap thingy. One of the members was a cat named Trevor Smith. Him and his friend Brian Higgins, we ended up changing our names later, and Brian became Charlie Brown and Trevor Smith became Busta Rhymes. But we had like a little crew, and we heard this other crew that was pretty well known on Long Island were having a contest, looking for people. So we went. And I battled and I won the DJ competition.
Mm.
And that group that had the contest became Public Enemy.
Hmm.
Now, I remember it very well because we were the only kids, you know, maybe 16. Well, Trevor was younger, Buster was younger, but me and Brown were the same age. And I think we were just started high school. We were young, and there was a line around the block. And I'm like, uh-oh, I don't know how this is going to go for us. But I bought in a certain B-boy aesthetic, you know. So I was online, and one guy came up to me, and he looks at me, and he goes, "Who are you supposed to be?" I'm like, "I don't know. Who are you supposed to be?" You know?
Yeah.
So he looked at me, and he looked at the guy that was behind him, and he goes, "I like this guy," right? I ended up winning, and that guy was Hank Shockley, the guy that started the Bomb Squad.
Hmm.
And the guy he was talking to was MC Chuck E. D., the guy that became Chuck D.
Hmm.
So, you know, my attitude, you know, which is a very hip-hop attitude, you know, let's do this and, you know, I'm ready to burn everybody. Let's go. Kind of helped push me over the edge there. There was a lot of people there.
Mm.
And that started my kind of career and, you know, in the making records portion of my journey. But it also lit a fire under me because Chuck D realized, yo, this guy's serious. Because there was a lot of people on that line. And there was other people that were picked. I was the only DJ, but there was other MCs that were picked. And he was very particular about who was serious and who he would mentor. And it ended up being me.
Hmm.
So I think that not only should you be creative or, you know, do what you do, but you have to have you shouldn't have to do anything, but you should have some kind of really burning inside desire to really get real good at your craft.
Right.
And develop it. Because some people just do. And that's what I did. But sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes you got to really work hard at it. Mm. A lot of times you got to really work hard at it if you really want to be somewhere.
Mm.
Thank you.
I love the way that you describe your craft as a DJ connected to your playing as a percussionist. You and I came together in that way, playing with my group, sitting in on congas, and I got to see your talents and your gifts. But what I love about that line that you draw back to the art form as a spiritual practice, and you know, also within that spiritual practice, as a nation that survived enslavement, survived colonization, you know, percussion was also a tool of resistance. It was reclaiming our humanity in the face of humanity, reclaiming our culture. It's interesting to me because the way that you describe that now, the work that you did and do as a DJ, it almost feels like an extension of that. Like you are continuing to bring in those rhythms, bring in that resistance, bring in that spiritual practice through the scratching and the work that you're doing in production. Does that resonate with you at all?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, before all of this, I was a martial artist. I started martial arts when I was 3, right? When my uncle came back from Vietnam, he started training me, and I've been a martial artist my whole life, more than anything I've ever done. And a martial arts practitioner realizes that the martial arts is a form of expression as well. Mm. And everything's an extension of you. So dancing was my first artistic expression outside of martial arts, mm-hmm. which is very similar, actually. Mm. Because when you feel something, it goes right from your brain to your body. That's probably the most purest form of expression is dance.
Right.
Because you don't have to think of a word to say something, or you don't have to write anything down, or you don't have to grab a piece of vinyl and scratch it. It just happens with your body. Eventually, when I started playing congas, again, it's an extension of my feeling. It's just but where I hit. And then extended to the turntables, extension of my arms, except it's now, instead of a round disc that I hit, it's a round disc that I manipulate.
Mm.
So all of this is all part of a physically rhythmic routine that my body has already conditioned itself
mm-hmm.
to actually create or to interpret how I feel.
Mm.
And that's important for me. There's been many times where I've been on my turntables, or I've been on my congas, or I've been on whatever I'm playing.
Right.
And I'm just playing, and then I don't record. And I've had somebody with me like, oh my God, did you record that? I'm like, no, I didn't. Right. What? Why not? I'm like, because that wasn't the important part.
Right.
Me getting it out was important.
Yes.
And I think that's missing now, because when people sit down to create, they're not really creating, they're manufacturing.
Mm, tell it.
So they'll sit there and say, I need to write this song for this certain demographic that does this. And it's kind of like making dog food. I got to make dog food for large canines that actually taste good for them. So no one ever says they create dog food. They say they manufacture it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do that with your music, it's more of a manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're so busy guiding it somewhere, where's the expression part, right? So what I do is I express, and then later I find out where that can fit.
Yeah.
But I don't do it beforehand, unless I'm doing a paid gig where it's a work for hire or something, and somebody says, hey, I need a beat that sounds like this. Okay, well, here you go. But if I'm doing it for myself, I just do. And then later on I say, now, what can I do with this?
Right.
But it has to have a feeling first.
I think that's so important. You know, when we talk about, I actually just spoke about this with Toshi Regan as well, about this idea that, you know, art, music in particular, is such a powerful tool to help us to tap into our emotions. You know, when we have experienced trauma, when we have just in all the different ways and for all the different reasons become numb to the world, you know, it helps us to wake up, to feel again, you know. And I know, for example, in Public Enemy, we felt that, you know, we felt as listeners, and do still, that energy, that emotional energy, that's so important, you know, in all the work that you've done that I know of, and I know I don't know it all, but I feel that emotional energy, you know. I can only imagine that you witnessed that, right? The impact that it has on an audience. What do you see? Like when they hear that emotional energy come through.
Well, you know, the irony is, like, when we wrote, I mean, if you listen to the first album, while there are some sociopolitical themes and things of that nature, there's some pretty ignorant things. Well, we kind of just throw in a little bit of, you know, conscious stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're going to get yours, right? Mm. So it starts off with, like, you know, if you mess with us, you're going to get yours. Mm. But in the middle of it, Chuck says, this government needs a tune-up. Because it's about the cars. You know, you're going to get just, my 98 Oldsmobile is so souped. We talk about the 98 Posse and these cars, how you mess with us, you know, there's going to be a problem. But then he starts going into things like, you know, you would get a tune-up on a car. He says the government needs a tune-up. You know, so he starts dropping these little things here and there, right? Mm. Even like, you know, the phenomenon of the, in this case, the woman, but it works both ways, who won't date her own kind because she looks down on them and thinks she's too good for that. Mm. And Chuck did a song called Sophisticated Bitch, which, by the way, Vernon Reid played the guitar on that record. So a new Vernon Reid, you know, prior to Living Color blowing up. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much unheard of in rap, where you brought up those kind of topics. And eventually we did a song called Riot Starter, a message to a black man. And we were told we couldn't use the word riot. Even though Sly and the Family Stone there's a riot going on that came out before that. So we had to change it to Right Starter, which makes no sense.
Oh, wow.
But the chorus was mind over matter, mouth in motion. Can't defy it because I never be quiet. Let's start this riot. Mm. But we couldn't say that in 1987. So it changed it to Right Starter, which is doesn't even make any sense. So we had some songs like that. And while they were kind of progressive and we were hitting hard, it wasn't hard enough until we got dissed, right? So Mr. Magic, RIP, first person to have rap music on commercial radio. Mr. Magic, by the way, was a Boricua. Mm. His last name was Rivas. Mm. And he dissed us and said, no more music by the suckers. And all over a misunderstanding. So that lit Chuck up. Like a lot. And then he wanted music that matched how he felt. So we all got mad, and that was reflected in the way the music was presented. They didn't just start with a beat like everybody else. We infused it with vocal snippets of everything from the Nation of Islam to parts of Watt Stacks and Brothers and Sisters. I don't know what this world is coming to. And then, bam, can, chicka, 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 chicka. And man, we wanted to basically punch you in the face with the music.
Right.
And in doing so, Chuck wanted to punch you right back with his lyrics. And it became this thing where everything was so agitated and it worked. At the time. I mean, I don't think we could ever do that again because of sample laws and all types of other stuff. And,
right.
And plus, I don't think musically the world is ready for that again, at least not yet. Mm. It's not. I mean, music runs in cycles. We are now back in the cycle of maybe early 80s where things are sparse and broken down and very simplistic, and it's going to start coming back up again. It does that in these cycles.
Oh, that's so interesting. It's so interesting. You know, I appreciate your wider lens, Johnny. You're always really great at looking at things from a wider lens and seeing patterns, you know. It kind of leads me to my next question, which is, how has hip-hop evolved? You know, what do you see as the most significant changes and developments today in hip-hop?
Well, I'm glad you used the word evolve, because I think people misunderstand the word and they think that it means gets better. Evolve means to adapt to your environment, to allow the survival of whatever it is. Mm. So if it means dumbing it down because that makes it more commercially viable, that makes it sell more, that makes it perpetuate and spread more, which makes it a huge success, then that's what evolving means. That doesn't mean it gets better lyrically. That doesn't mean the music gets more advanced, because to be honest with you, the most advanced things are the most simplistic things. Mm. The best designs are the simplest designs. Mm. the more complex you make it, the more points it could fail.
Mm.
And I'm an engineer. I'm an electrical engineer. So
right.
the more points you give it to fail, the more apt it is to fail. So you try to make it as simple as possible. Hip-hop has evolved by basically embedding itself in every other genre.
Mm.
You can't hear anything without hearing some kind of hip-hop thing. I mean, you had people like James M. Toomey who disliked hip-hop a lot and said it wasn't really creative because of the samples, end up using samples on some of his stuff. And he did that song Juicy Fruit, but his father was one of the Heath brothers who was sampled extensively on their Smiling Billy suite by everybody from Nas to you name it.
Mm.
And James M. Toomey was a drumming prodigy. But then you have, like, you know, I've seen Stevie Wonder singing with DJ Spinner scratching Funky Drummer at a bar. It's crazy. So it gets to the point where hip hop is now, it's almost like interwoven into the fabric of America now, where you can't not see it.
Right.
McDonald's, Burger King commercials, you're going to see a graffiti piece up there. It's, you know, you name it, hip hop is somehow a part of it. And that's how it has evolved. It evolved basically to become a huge symbiote that finds hosts and it grabs it and it becomes a part of the host. Now you can't tell if a song is an R&B record with a rapper on it or a hip hop record with a singer on it. It's like, which one is it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but the thing is, I've always wanted to commit genrecide because I hate genres because it doesn't make sense. I try to explain some of my music with the Odyssey. I can't.
Right.
It's just me.
Right.
And my partner.
That's right.
Making music. But hip hop has become a thing where it's like, it's almost undefinable because what it used to be isn't what it is right now. And that's fine as well because, you know, it's not supposed to be defined. It's only supposed to be enjoyed.
Right. And has your role evolved as well in response to these changes? How is your role involved in hip hop?
My role has always been the same. I express myself and hope that other people could listen to it and say, hey, I get that.
Mm.
And if they do, they do this. If they don't, that's fine. Because in real life, people don't get you.
Mm-hmm.
And some people get you. And mm-hmm. that's the way it is, you know. I think all artists want to be heard.
Yeah.
And they want to be understood as well. But I don't think it's a quantity game.
Hmm.
I'd rather have 5 friends that really understand me than 100 people that kind of get, that kind of know me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's always been like that. And that is the basis of grassroots movements.
Right.
You find people that really want to be part of that.
Right.
Not casuals.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Because what happens is the casuals find something else later anyway they like.
Right.
But the people that really, really believe, they'll never leave.
Right.
So my role's always been the same. I just create. As the Joker said in The Dark Knight, I just do.
Yes. But you do some interesting stuff, though, these days. You do some interesting collaborations. You just mentioned The Odyssey. I don't know if you want to say something about that, but that seems to be like an interesting journey that has taken you musically into new places.
Well, yeah. You know, here's the thing. I never changed anything I did to do The Odyssey.
Mm.
I just added a different type of vocalist onto it.
Okay.
Like a song, Cold Blooded. The bass line, which I wrote, is very jazz influenced. The drums are funk influenced.
Yeah.
The pads and the strings behind it are very pop and R&B-ish.
Mm.
And the vocals, I can't even tell you what they sound like. He sounds kind of like almost like a Sting.
I was going to say that. I was going to say right. that exact same thing.
Kind of like that, but not really.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's a 6'5" white South African, and I'm a 5' something Puerto Rican from the Bronx. So couldn't get further apart, mm-hmm. you know, as far as our backgrounds. But we both believe in fighting injustice and talking about things that aren't really talked about as much.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know this, you put somebody on a track that you never thought you should have put on it, and now all of a sudden it's like, whoa, it transforms the song.
Right.
Had I put a rapper on it, he probably would have rapped about the same stuff that everybody does, and it would have been like, okay. You know, if I put a regular R&B song, we would have been in the club or something like that. You know, so the thing is, since I bought somebody with a different point of view, it changed, it almost changed the direction of the music itself.
Absolutely.
But that kind of music is stuff I've always written. I've just always had a hard time trying to find people that want to like it. Like, I would give it to a rapper and he'd be like, you ain't got nothing to sound more like the Timbaland record or something that sounds like, and I'm like, yeah, but that's done already. Yeah. Let's try something new.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find those people. Chuck was one of those people, Chuck D. And KJ from The Odyssey was one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, I was only asked to scratch on some of his solo stuff, which I did. And then I told them, you know, not all of them songs needed scratching. I said, if I'm talking as a producer, maybe two of those songs. And he was like, oh, well, do you have anything you have laying around? I'm like, as a matter of fact, I do.
Yeah.
And that's how The Odyssey started. It was kind of like a mistake, and it ended up working for us.
Well, that brings me to another question that I have, which is around your many facets of music. You have ventured into film and TV music scoring and soundtracks. So in addition to percussionist and DJ, you are also composing music. How do you think music and visual storytelling can make a positive impact on our world?
Well, have you ever worked on, doing scores?
I just started getting into that.
All right, so the wild thing about scores is you're not the main focus.
Right.
Right?
Truth.
The visual is. So that's a weird way to approach music writing, right? Because when you do it, you know, as a song or as a, you know, you're doing a show, you're the center of attention. Right. So now you have to become the supporting thing for this bigger thing.
Yes.
And to a lot of people, that is almost impossible because their whole existence has been me, 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 look at me, me, look at my problems I've been having, listen to my pain. And now you have to interpret something and bring out the pain in that piece. Mm-hmm. And it can be a challenge, but sometimes it can be a very rewarding thing if you're actually able to tap into something and pull it out. And then the director goes, that's exactly how I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. And obviously, you have to have a background in actual music. And I don't mean that in a snobby way. I come from hip hop. Well, I come from music. But since I'm known for hip hop, it's automatically assumed that, oh, he can't read or write music. And that's not the case, obviously.
Right.
But you have to know this.
Yeah.
Or else it's just not going to work.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, yeah, you can get away with stuff, but nobody's going to take a whole sample-based score because
mm-hmm.
it's just too expensive to license. So you have to be able to be flexible. You have to change things. You know, the director's always going to come back, hey, you know what? Great, but I just cut 10 seconds out of that scene. Well, now the whole flow of what you wrote is different. You can't just take 10 seconds out and it's the same feel.
Right.
So these things, are not really considered by people that just start getting into it. They think, oh, I'll just write a beat. I'll be all
right. Right.
Nah.
No.
It doesn't work that way.
No.
And it gets worse. I mean, I scored Ali Rap for ESPN and they didn't even give me video.
Mm.
So I did the theme song to it. They're like, you know how to score? I'm like, yeah. They said, yo, can you score this? I'm like, yeah, when do you need it? They're like, yesterday. I'm like, okay, well, send me some clips. They didn't have any yet. I'm like, well, then how can I possibly score this? So they gave me cue sheets.
Oh, wow. You know?
003 seconds, Muhammad Ali walks into the gym. Need music that's frantic, mm-hmm. you know, excitable, ends at 35 seconds as fades into black. So I had to look at those things, and I wrote like 8 pieces for the pieces that he wanted.
Yeah.
And I did it like in a night. And then the next day I sent it to him, and a day later they sent me an email back saying, perfect. We just need you to do tags because it was on TV, so they needed a... like a ding-ding-ding-ding-ding to go in a commercial and to come back, right? So I didn't do that. So I found one of the pieces they wanted for that, and I made a tag for it, and I made a tag coming in and out. And I got nominated for an Emmy Award for Outstanding Music Composition for that.
For the one that you had no visuals when you scored
right.
it. Wow.
Yeah. And I did it in like about 20 hours.
Unbelievable.
And I said, wow, I'm lucky. But then I did... Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's On the Shoulders of Giants. I got nominated for a few NAACP Image Awards.
Mm-hmm.
So it became a thing I started doing more. because one, it was a challenge, and I'm like, okay, well, this is different. You know, giving beats to rappers gets tiring after a while because they always turn down most of your beats. Nah, I don't like that one. Nah, I don't like that one. Nah, I was like, it becomes like a you're on one of those jukeboxes that, you know, you kind of keep switching up songs.
Right.
Meanwhile, if you tell them that the song that they wrote, that rap they wrote, nah, I don't like that one, give me another one. They'll lose it.
Mm.
That's me, though. That's, yo, come on, man. That's who I am. You can't stop. I'm like, I didn't get that mad when you turned down 17 of my beats in the
Right.
So I find it kind of funny in that respect. Mm. But when you do scoring, you get shot down a lot. They'll tell you they want something, you give it to them, then they're like, nah, yeah, I want something with horns that sounds loud. And then eventually, after six tries, you give them some string stuff that doesn't sound loud. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. That's exactly not what you asked for. But you know,
I know exactly what you're talking about so much. I really do.
So it's like, yeah, okay. So after a while, you know, you learn to play the game, but it can be real rewarding if you stick with it.
I think for me, you know, as somebody who's new to getting into scoring, so I got into scoring primarily, I started with my own documentaries that I was working on and like creating some score for that. But then I wanted to move into collaboration with other folks. So I have a web series and then one that's a documentary and one that's a narrative. And the narrative one was interesting for me, Johnny, because they had no score. There was no music throughout the entire piece. This is a narrative short. But at the very end, the last 30 seconds, the music comes in. I cannot tell you how much I sweated figuring out what those 30 seconds of sound were, figuring out what part of this emotion needs to be uplifted and not overtaken. And I think you really spoke to this well, that, you know, the music's not the centerpiece. You know, I'm used to making music that's the centerpiece. So how can this piece not get in the way, but really just weave in gently in a way that can enhance it?
Those things are all often, they're so subtle and they're so nuanced, and people are so used to just being in your face that a lot of people don't pay attention to that. I watched that movie No Country for Old Men recently again. There's no score.
Mm.
There's zero music. Other than what's playing like when he walks into a gas station or something.
Right.
There's no score. Mm. You know how well it has to be written for the director to create enough tension without the music making it tense? That's crazy. I was watching it. I'm like, wow. The actors were phenomenal, and that's why it worked. But the easiest way to see that, to kind of visualize what we mean, is watch a horror movie.
Mm.
Somebody opens the door and you hear, ring! You know, that sound, that string that comes up, that high-pitched ring, ring! And then everybody goes, oh, and then it's like psych. You know, nobody dies, nobody gets stabbed, but that sound effect made you almost jump out of your seat. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then the next time that sound effect happens, it happens with a low bass underneath it to give it gravity. So while the first one was, it's like, turn your head real quick. Oh, it's only you. Oh, Brian. Oh, turn. Then the next one has the sound and the low end so that it becomes guttural.
Right.
So those kind of things, like, it may seem intuitive. It is as you're listening and watching it. But to create it, you have to figure that out and figure out how can I interpret me feeling nauseous because a guy's head just got chopped off, and, you know, at the same time, shocking. So, yeah, the high pitched stuff scares you. The low stuff kind of makes you feel a little queasy.
Yeah.
You know, and these are things that, like, you either learn from somebody that's a master, like somebody like John Williams, or, you know, or, and they all have their own style, you know, their own style of scoring. You know, John Williams scoring, that's Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
And then you got weird ones like, you know, all of Tim Burton's movies, you know, they're all scored by the Oingo Boingo guy. So, and they all have that quirky, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, and that's why it's so hard to break into that. Because once a director finds a guy that he knows, understands him, he's picking that dude to score all this stuff.
Right. So. Yeah, it's like learning a language. It's like understanding their language. It makes me think about, this is a little off track, but I remember when I was giving birth to my son, and I had made a playlist, right? That Gaetano, I'm sorry, my daughter. I was giving birth to my daughter, and I made a playlist that Gaetano was supposed to play. And Gaetano puts it on. And within seconds, I was like, no, no, that's not it. Turn it off. Turn it off. I got like really irate. You know, when you're in labor, you're not mincing words, you know, just giving commands. Turn it off. And I was like, you have to play. I wanted this. It was a specific flamenco song that comes from the mines, that comes from miners, Tarantos. So it's this like almost like these love songs that were sung in darkness, right? They were composed in these mines by gitanos. And there was something about that sound that I needed in that moment. You know, it was a very specific emotion, and only that specific sound could meet the vibration that I was at in that moment. Probably literally, physically, you know, and emotionally, that vibration. But right. It's like, if it doesn't meet right, it's not gonna fly. You know, it's not gonna do what it needs to do. So I know that I'm talking real life and we're talking film, but you know, it's all interconnected.
No, it's all the same. I mean, that makes 100% sense, me knowing your daughter.
It's true.
I was like, wow, that does make sense. My daughter, my youngest daughter was born, and the moment she came out, Mark Anthony's Nadia Con Ella came on. And that was like the perfect song because there's no one like her. Yeah. But I wasn't the one that chose the playlist because I'm not stupid. the woman chooses the playlist.
Speaking of young people and imprints, as a mentor and an educator, you've had a profound impact on the next generation of artists. And I wanted to know what advice you would offer to young people who are passionate about using hip hop to make a more just and liberated world. What advice would you give them for the next 50 years to come?
Well, that's a good question. I would first implore them to explore the world. Mm. Many artists, or young artists, up and coming artists, spend most of their time in front of a computer or somewhere writing. But you can't write anything of substance if you're not out there experiencing things to write about.
Truth.
It's almost like a painter. If you're a painter painting a painting of yourself painting, how interesting is that going to be? If all you do is paint, you have to see something to say, I would love to paint that. Mm. So if you're so busy sitting in your room trying to think of things to write, the amount of material you have to work with is limited. So go out and experience things, you know, because people, I feel these days are so busy trying to make money doing this that they're regurgitating things that they've heard, you know, with their little spin on it. And, you know, oh, I hear, well, that's what happens in my hood. And I'm like, well, there's a lot of things that happen in your hood, not the same four things. You know, so why does it always have to be the same four things? You know? I heard somebody tell me one time that, well, I like to talk about things that are real. I said, you know what was real? My grandmother used to put me on the free cheese line, the welfare cheese line, while she went around the corner and did her shopping. And when she came back, she grabbed me, we grabbed the cheese, and she'd go make me a grilled cheese sandwich by trying to cut that big block of cheese down. That's real to me.
Yes.
But nobody talks about that,
right?
You know? Which is why, you know, like Hector Lavoe and Willie Colon became big writing songs about things that most salseros were not writing about back in those days. They're all writing about the same thing, how great Puerto Rico was, how great the food is, and beautiful woman. But then, you know, Hector and Willie wrote songs about their grandmother, about how bad a certain side of the street was.
Right.
You know, they were very poetic, but they also wrote about things that weren't exactly the subjects that were popular at the time.
Yeah.
And that's what endeared them to the people. Because there's a lot of stories out there.
Right.
There's been a whole bunch of baby mama songs, and they were always negative until Miss Jackson by Outkast. You know, where they're apologizing for doing their baby mama wrong, and they apologize to her mother, like, yo, you know. So there's a lot of ways to tell stories, a lot of stories to tell, but you got to go out there and live those stories first.
Right.
So yes. that's my biggest advice to any young person. Go live so that you have something to talk about.
That's right. That's right. Oh, I love that, Johnny. That's such good advice. Thank you so much for all this. And I'm wishing you the best in all that you're doing, the scoring and new work that you have coming up with Public Enemy as well, right?
Public Enemy, we'll be touring next year. New music for DMC, from Run DMC. I did two songs on his new rock album.
Nice.
That he has coming out. Yep, I finally have a Johnny Juice album in the works.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And it'll be 100% not what you think it's going to be. Well, there's two. One of them's going to be a DJ-centric album because people have been asking for that. The other one, when you hear it, you're going to be...
It's going to be all flute.
It's not going to be flute. It's going to be flugelhorn. Well, I will be playing pretty much every instrument on it. And and it's not going to be what you think.
I can't wait.
I'll also be doing vocals on it, so.
Really? Like singing vocals?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I sang background on the Odyssey stuff, but this is going to, I'll be doing lead on this, on some of this stuff. And it's gonna be interesting.
So, oh, I cannot wait. When are we going to hear that?
This will probably be sometime around my birthday in July.
Okay. All right. I look forward to celebrating your birthday and your new album with you.
Me too.
All right. Thanks, Johnny. Take care.
Thank you so much, Diana.
That concludes another episode of The Rhythm of Rebellion. I'd like to express my deepest gratitude to DJ Johnny Juice for sharing his insights and stories with us today. To stay connected with DJ Johnny Juice, you can find him at johnnyjuice.wixsite.com and on Instagram at DJ Johnny Juice. I'm Taina Asili, your host. You can keep up with my work on Instagram and YouTube at Taina Asili, on Facebook at Taina Asili Music, or on my website at tainaasili.com. All of these links will be shared in the show notes. Many thanks to our editor, Moses Nagel, and Sina Basila Hickey at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and leave your thoughts about the podcast. Your feedback is invaluable and helps to continue to bring these thought-provoking conversations. Until next time, peace, love, and liberation.